Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Tammy Eagle Bull was raised in Aberdeen, and she's a member of the Oglala Lakota Nation. She's also the first Native American woman in the United States to become a licensed architect. Tomorrow is the annual Institute of Architects South Dakota Convention, where Eagle Bull gives the keynote titled Sovereignty Through Design. And she joins us now in the Sioux Falls studios. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Tammy.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome home. So tell me a little bit about coming home to South Dakota. How's that experience for you? How often do you get back?
I get back, you know, every few weeks. My folks now live in Pine Ridge, so near Rapid City. But I did grow up in Aberdeen. I haven't been up there in a while, though.
So where do you currently live?
I live in Lincoln, Nebraska now.
Okay, so you're
not too far away, and my firm does a lot of projects here in South Dakota.
So some folks, as we were talking, you know, about getting you on the show, we were saying, oh, this is the first Native American licensed architect. And there was a few like, well, really? How is that possible? I mean, it's 2018.
Yeah.
So really, how is that possible?
that's kind of what I was thinking. The first Native American male or female was licensed in 1967. He was one of my mentors, Lou Weller, and then I became licensed in 1994. So yeah, it did take a while to. It's just not a profession I think that is well known to tribal people, and something that I think is really even in mainstream schools is really kind of put out there as an opportunity. I would not have heard about architecture as a profession had it not been for my dad.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, because this is something that he thought he would want to do, and that door was closed to him. Tell me a little bit about hearing from him growing up.
Well, he was always, I think, very conscious of what was going on with the tribes. Both my parents were raised on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and they chose to raise us off the reservation so that we would have other opportunities. But we would go back quite often to visit family, and I would spend summers with my grandma there. And I'd always ask about the disparity between the schools that my cousins went to and then the school I went to up in Aberdeen, and it was completely different. The housing was different. You know, the hospital was different. Everything was different. And he would explain to me, you know, kind of why that was. And he had told me, he had all these architectural books in our basement, too. So I would always look at those, and I thought they were really cool, the, you know, the drawing books and the lettering books. And he was explaining to me why it was important for there to be Native American architects. He knew of a few in his job. He was involved in some of the new school construction that was happening in tribes back in the 70s. And he saw architects coming from all over the country to work on these schools without any input from the community. They would just design a school and bring it out, and it would start construction. And you know, the people would just have to kind of live with what they thought was best for them.
Right. So he had seen firsthand how things could go wrong mm-hmm. without the right perspective.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And so he would talk to me a lot about that, about how he thought. The people, teachers, community needed to be involved in process.
All right. So tell me, you know, you have these conversations with your father. You have access to these books. When do you look at the books and then come into a building or a space and say, and make the connection between? Because it's not enough to just say, I want to be an architect. Mm-hmm. At some point, you have to get it.
Yeah.
Did you get it at some point when you were a kid that what's happening in these books are the places that I walk into?
Yeah, I remember my earliest memory of knowing that I was going to be an architect was when I was about 8. Wow. And so, you know, a lot of different influences, you know, my dad and then I think just seeing the unfairness of what was happening, you know, back at Pine Ridge with my family, and then, you know, what I was able to have up in Aberdeen. And then also, you know, like silly things like that was when the Brady Bunch was a big, was a big TV show, and I used to watch that all the time too. So I think it was, that was when I knew I wanted to be an architect. I don't think it was until maybe, you know, 5 or so years after I graduated from architectural school that I really could start to see how I could make a change there.
Sure.
You know?
So at eight, you don't say, I want to be the first female Native
no.
American architect. You just say, hey, I like architecture.
Yeah, I like to draw. I like science. Yeah. I like math. And
did you know how many doors were closed for you? Like, when did you start realizing, okay, I'm doing something that is different for me in my experience as a woman, as Indigenous, or just, you know, from your particular background, that said this path is going to be a little bit different for me than it would be of you know, someone else.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, you know, my parents were really, really good at just encouraging me to do whatever I wanted to do, and were very supportive. So I never really had the sense when I was, you know, in high school and all this, that I couldn't do anything because of who I was. Or my background. It wasn't until I got to architecture school, my third year in architecture school, where I really started to feel some barriers and some, not really any people telling me I couldn't do stuff, but, you know, other students thinking I was there because of a quota system or you know, my process and my projects looking vastly different than everybody else's projects. And that I was starting to see came from my experience. My life experience was a lot different than theirs.
Tell me one of those stories. When you sort of look at something about the result or the process, and you notice for the first time that what you're doing, you know, is different than really, you know, because you're not being taught that if everyone else is doing something different. It's just what you're bringing to the process. So when do you notice that for the first time? What does that look like?
It was one of our projects. I kind of was struggling in design studio, and we were given these projects to design. It was like, okay, you're going to design a health clinic. There was no client. There was no information. It was just square footages. We need these rooms and now design it. And I would always really struggle on, you know, what was the story of the building going to be? And, you know, my classmates were designing these, you know, great things, and they were all developing a style that was, you know, theirs, that you could look at any project they designed and it was going to be that person's style. And I didn't have a style yet, and I was really struggling. And then our next project, we had an actual client. We were doing some ideas for this foundation that was wanting to build a school for autistic children. And we got to meet with the teachers and the executive director and really get input. And I was just loving that. And I remember talking to my studio critic saying, you know, this is great. I just really, you know, like, you know, my project was amazing on that one. And I really loved it. And, you know, that was when it became clear to me that I just needed that. I can't design in a vacuum. I needed that interaction with the client.
Which for the rest of the world, maybe who have not gone to architecture school, that sounds pretty intuitive that you would want to know what the client wants.
Yeah.
So when architects come, you know, into a situation, and particularly a tribal situation, they're often looking at winning awards, you've said. You're not interested in putting your structures up for awards. You're interested in listening to the community. So let's talk about tribal projects specifically and the importance of, you know, what can go wrong with the wrong perspective and what can go right if you come at it from a respectful space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think with tribal projects, let me back up a little bit. In architecture education, when I was in school, we were taught, you're going to be the expert. You know what's best. You go in and you solve the problem. And I think that's been the approach with tribal communities for far too long. Architects come in there saying, okay, there's all these issues with tribes, and we're going to solve this problem with a building. And we're going to, you know, give them what we think will help them. And I think the intent is always good when it's approached that way, but it's the issues that tribes face are a lot deeper than that. And I think when architects go in and either see, you know, awards in their future because of all the great inspiration and cultural ideas to draw upon, they're decision making becomes about that and not really about what's best for the client. And I've seen and talked to tribes who've had bad experiences where they have this, you know, award winning, you know, really beautiful building and no one has ownership in it. No one feels attached to it. They're like, yeah, you know, they just came and put this up and, you know, it doesn't work for us. You know, there's in the 70s and 80s, there was this, you know, trend towards architects designing schools and buildings in the shape of animals. So there are, you know, there are schools in the shape of eagles and turtles and buffalo and, you know, and I've seen those. And, you know, when you try to, cram function into a pre-described shape, you get all these crazy, shaped rooms and classrooms that don't work and stuff. And so those type of things, I think, are kind of the what I've tried to learn from when I've talked to clients about, you know, what not to do. And we really try to listen to them. And I go into the project telling the client, you guys are the expert in whatever building, if it's a school or if it's a, you know, gas station, whatever we're doing, you guys are the expert. This is your building. You know, I have a certain expertise in terms of construction and building materials and how to do the process, but you guys know your building. You guys know your function.
Yeah. So a building can create a problem if it's shaped in a way that makes no sense. Can a building solve a problem?
I think so. I think that a lot of the issues and kind of crises that are going on in Indian country now kind of affect the cultural identity and the feeling of pride that people have, tribal people have, especially the children. And I've seen firsthand when children are involved in projects and involved in their, like, a school, designing a school, and we give them a voice and we listen to what they say, they become then owners of that building and they take care of it, and that doesn't become, they don't let people vandalize it, and they feel proud of it, and it becomes kind of a center of their community, and it helps them then start to feel pride in themselves. And I think that can go a long way towards, starting to address some of the issues that are happening in Indian country now.
So help me get my mind around, you know, you're anywhere in the world and somebody's asking you to design a school. How do you reasonably invite the children who are in that school to be part of the process in a way that they have ownership? What does that look like?
Well, what we do is we have what we call cultural values workshops or community values workshops, depending on where we're at. But we'll have individual workshops with the children. So we'll ask the parents and the staff to come. Usually it's in the evening on a couple nights a week so that everybody has an opportunity. Feed them a meal. We talk to them a little bit about what we're trying to do. And then we take the kids aside and we give them paper and pencils and crayons and whatever they want. And we just tell them, what do you want in your school? And we just let them write or draw or whatever they want. And we'll ask, questions like, how do you want to feel when you come to school? Can you express that? What's the best thing about coming to school? What's the worst thing about coming to school? And we ask them to answer these, very simple questions. And it's very similar to what we do with the adults. We do the same thing with the adults. What are your three biggest concerns about sending your children to school? What are the things you want most from your child going to school each day? It's just open-ended questions like that, and we get all the answers. And the kids always come up with, there's crazy answers like we want a swimming pool or, stuff like that. But there was, a lot of very, insightful answers from their perspective.
So your education in architecture begins after you get your license and you start really listening to these people, or it continues in a whole new way.
Yeah, it's exactly like, and like I said, it didn't take, it wasn't until I had been out of school 5 or 6 years where I started to, this kernel started to develop as to how this process should go.
What do kids want from a school that makes sense and that you have learned from, from parents, from teachers, from children about school design that you didn't learn in architecture school?
Tribal students, we hear a lot from them that they want it to be safe. They want it to be like home because sadly, a lot of tribal students, their home life isn't that great. They may be facing issues of alcoholism or abuse, or in a lot of cases, coming to school is the only place that they get a hot meal. So the school means a lot more to them than it does mainstream students. you know, mainstream students, you know, they're bored at school. They're, you know, it's about socialization and stuff. And for tribal students, it's a lot more. It become, you know, the teachers, you know, maybe the, you know, kind word they hear that day from a teacher. So it's much deeper, and the school needs to be friendlier, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah. And how do you translate that into good design?
What we did in one of the schools was we talked to the teachers about doing learning pods. So we created these houses, learning houses, and jointly put a couple different grades together so they could learn from each other and have a big space that several grades, classrooms were around, so that they would have this kind of feeling of a living room mm-hmm. and a community that's smaller than the whole school. Because, you know, when a school is 300 and some students, even though you're related to and know most of those students, it's always better to break that down as small as possible so that the child feels like they have a routine and they have a safe place that they know every day.
Do you get feedback after a project is complete?
Yeah, I was interesting. I just went back to one of the schools that we designed. It's been open about 5 years now. I was back last fall, and I had a film crew with me, and they were flying a drone and stuff around. And just, you know, I went to a couple classrooms. I ate lunch with the kids, and just they were so excited, and they were so proud of the building. They were showing me things about the building, like, you know, like, hey, did you know this? And, you know, telling me about the building. So it was really, this isn't the generation that we worked with. The generation that we worked with, you know, the kindergartners were, you know, gone now. So, because it's been over 8 years, I guess. So it was a whole new generation of students who, you know, weren't involved firsthand. But they had heard this, and they had, so that knowledge was passed down, and feeling of community and ownership was passed down somehow.
So that gives me goosebumps, just thinking about you going back into that space and hearing that. That has to be very affirming, you know.
It was wild.
In a world
was...
where you don't always get affirmed for your work to be, you know, and people can throw awards at you, which are wonderful and well-deserved, but there's probably a few things as satisfying as that.
Yeah, that beat everything. I mean, that's worth more than any award I could get, because it's what I've hoped. It's like when you have this thesis and you put it out there and you're hoping it comes true, and then you get go there and it did.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the award, the Whitney M. Young Jr. Award. Tell me a little bit about what that award represents.
Whitney M. Young Jr. was the president of the NAACP in the 1960s. So this award is given yearly to a person, an architect who embodies social change or social justice, who fights for diversity or inclusiveness. And so I was honored to be recognized for my work in Indian Country. And I think the award to me means that I'm trying to do something right, and that, you know, I'm trying to make my career about more than just, you know, buildings that are attributed to me.
Yeah. And you spoke about statistic irrelevance of Native Americans in architecture. So you weren't afraid, and you got a standing ovation for that for that address, but you weren't afraid to say the work here is by no means done.
Right. There's a lot, you know, the Whitney M. Young spoke to the convention, the National Architects Convention in 1968. So this is the 50th year anniversary of his talk. And he kind of, you know, he was pretty hard on them. He told them that their thunderous silence and complete irrelevance to the issue of civil rights was what architects were known for at the time. And so I kind of repeated that message and said, you know, in the 50 years, have we done enough as a profession? You know, Native Americans, we are less than 1%, so we don't even show up on the charts of architects in the Institute of Architects. So, and then I talked a little bit about how, you know, given all the things that the Institute is doing, there's still a lot more that needs to be done and should be done.
So speak, if you will, directly to some of the listeners right now who are young people of color, young Indigenous people of color, who say, yeah, architecture wasn't even on my list of things. What kind of people do you think need to go into architecture? Who, you know, what is the spark that you would say, if you think this, you should study this?
Yeah, for me it was, I knew I wanted to help, come back into Indian country and help in some way, but I knew it wasn't going to be as a doctor or as a lawyer or any type of, you know, social worker type area, because those really weren't my strengths or my interest. And I would say somebody who has the desire to come back and help and make a difference in the built environment, architecture is a great way, because you can help and you can make a difference. And it's the one area that I see on tribes that that is lacking in terms of reflecting the culture. It used to be, you know, back pre-colonization, that our communities reflected exactly who we were, what our economy was, what our, you know, hierarchy was, what our lifestyle was, and reflected the environment, the climate. Now our communities don't reflect anything about us other than the bad things, poverty and, you know, unemployment and all that. And so now is the time that our built environments need to change back to reflecting who we are.
Tammy Eagleball, thank you so much for being with us. It's Sovereignty Through Design is the keynote speech that's at AIA's South Dakota Annual Convention. You can see her Thursday, September 13th at 7:30 p.m. That keynote at the Ramkota Convention Center in Sioux Falls is open to the public. Thank you for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.